Gripped by snow today, with over 4 inches falling overnight across the city. 220 of the region's schools have been closed, and the city's buses were suspended with a skeleton service currently running. For some Bristolians, the snow has caused real problems, but for others, it's been welcomed.
I'm feeling quite excited because all day we've been outside making igloos, making snowman, and it's been really nice. And the bad thing is that it's slippy, but just got to think on the positive side.
There's been major disruption at Bristol Airport, and the city's roads have been affected, with motorway closures and some of the main routes across the city at a standstill. The snow is due to continue into the evening, with rain forecast overnight, making roads even more treacherous over the weekend. The Jelly Records Bristol Acoustic Music Festival opening night has been cancelled due to the weather, and an array of services across the city have also been affected. Police are advising people not to make a journey unless absolutely necessary, and to check on vulnerable people or family who may be on their own. Production has been suspended at an Irish meat processing plant after new tests revealed horse DNA in its frozen burgers. The firm said it believed the contamination had come from one supplier after further results from the Irish Department of Agriculture. And in world news, Algerian forces launched their rescue mission, fearing an immediate threat to the hostages. David Cameron has told the House of Commons. The attempt to rescue gas workers taken hostage by Al-Qaeda-linked militants ended in a number of deaths, including one Briton. The Prime Minister put off a high-profile speech on Europe to stay in London and oversee developments. And that's the latest. More news in an hour.
BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station. BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on. BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on. You can count on.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, it's glorious out there, and it's BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Hoping you're tucked up warm. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour MP for Newport West, Paul Flynn. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Africa in the news this week, new war in Mali and hundreds taken hostage at a BP Algerian gas plant right on the Libyan border, surprisingly enough. Plus, Bristol South's super safe seated Labour MP, Deputy Speaker Dawn Primorolo, has warned the new mayor, George Ferguson, against tinkering with the proposed bus rapid transit system. But is it the right way forward? Transport writer and former MEP for the region, Richard Cottrell, is about to bring out his book all about the railway axeman Dr. Beeching, 50 years after the Beeching Axe in 2013. He gives a perspective from outside the city now. He lives in Italy. Plus, the disturbing issue of suicide, in particular teenage suicide clusters in South Wales, Bridge End being the most well-known. A Caerphilly man believes he's identified the cause, at least in part, suicide reduction initiatives that actually do the opposite. And if he's right, the most worrying side is it's being funded with our taxpayers' money. And Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, unsurprisingly tonight, below freezing, only minus 1 degree Celsius though, so not too cold. Get out and enjoy if you've got some warm clothes and decent boots, that kind of thing. And there's still a little bit more light snow tonight. This weekend, highs 0 Celsius, fairly cloudy on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday with some possible light snow in the evening. So it doesn't look like it's going to be getting above freezing until next week. Next week, highs of 3 Celsius, some sunshine, but also some possible light snow. Next weekend, that's the 26th and 27th of January, highs up again, a bit more to the seasonal normal, 10 degrees Celsius, cloudy with some light showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour MP for Newport West, Paul Flynn. Hi, Paul, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you. Well, very nice to be on.
Thankfully, not having to get here in person, but on the phone. A lot more comfortable. Are you nice and warm where you are, Paul?
It's lovely, yeah. I mean, it's been a beautiful day. The garden looks lovely. I've got five of my grandchildren here, so if you hear any noises off, you'll understand. But okay. We've had a great ride of a day.
Now, you're a Labour MP, and you were recently, well, a few months ago anyway, suspended from the House of Commons. We covered it on this programme, but can you just give us your point of view of what happened and why you were suspended?
It wasn't planned, but I'm very angry about people who are dying in Afghanistan, but I believe for no reason. I believe the war is over. There's no purpose in being there anymore. And there's a lie that's been perpetuated in the House of Commons, and that's the lie that says that our brave soldiers are going to Afghanistan to protect Britain, protect us from terrorism. Well, there's absolutely no threat of terrorism from the Taliban in Afghanistan. I mean, threats of terrorism from about a dozen sources in Britain, but it's not from Afghanistan. And this was repeated 3 days running in the House of Commons, and I said that the only reason that our troops have been sent to Afghanistan is to act as human shields for the reputations of politicians. They want to try and spin a tidy end to the war in Afghanistan, but lives are being lost, and it's very similar to the end of the First World War, when politicians lie and soldiers die. And at that point, the Speaker interrupted me and said, "Are you saying that ministers are lying?" And there was no answer to that except yes. I do believe that ministers have lied, and I do believe that we've lost precious lives, 440 lives now, because of that lie. And for that, I was expelled from the House. But, I mean, it was very well worthwhile in terms of the fact that those words of mine, something I've been saying since 2006, got onto the national news and were broadcast all over the world. And so it was worth making that point. But I believe we're in a situation now which is very perilous, and that's the getting involved in every war that takes place. I mean, there's very few people in this country have actually heard of Mali before today, yet why us? Why do we commit ourselves? And last Monday in Parliament, I said that by going into Mali, we've exposed ourselves to the possibility of reprisals from terrorists. This was far more dangerous. And we now know the tragic situation that we're in today. A life has been lost already, one United Kingdom life, and there may be more. But we gung-ho, and repeatedly we hear from William Hague in particular that Britain must punch above our weight. Punching above our weight means spending beyond our responsibilities and dying beyond our interests.
Well, that's a pretty strong accusation, though, to say that ministers are lying. Do you have evidence for that?
Well, that is a lie. I mean, to suggest, it was said, as I said, by two different ministers on 3 days in the Commons. If we said to a Taliban, "Why are you killing British troops? Why are you blowing them up?" Would they say, "Oh, when we've killed all the British troops, we're coming over to Bristol and to Newport and Cardiff and blow up your streets?" They certainly would not. What they would say is, "We're killing British soldiers because you are the foreigners, you're the Ferengi, you're in our country, and it's our sacred religious duty to expel them. You're here by force of arms, and we must fight against you as our fathers did, as our grandfathers did, and our great-grandfathers did."
But Paul, hang on a second.
If we get out of the country, they can't kill us. Now, Canada and the Netherlands have come out of the Taliban. There aren't terrorists blowing up the streets in Amsterdam and Toronto. And we're saying to soldiers, go there and protect us from terrorism. There is no truth in that statement. And by normal parlance, that is a lie. And a lie in which is leading people to sacrifice their lives.
Now, what do you say then to for those with friends, relatives, even sons or daughters who are fighting in Afghanistan?
They're in a position, I mean, those who've lost lives, and I'm very much involved with organizations, particular organizations to deal with the, we've lost 440, as I say, but 2,000 others have returned broken in body and in mind. And we've had recent wars in the Falklands and in Vietnam, where more soldiers have taken their lives after the war than died in combat. And we'll probably have a similar situation there. I was saying to them, for goodness sake, recognize this. There's going to be a terrible moment for those families who got some consolation from the fact that, well, all right, we've lost a member of our family. We're going to have a wound of grief that will never heal, but they're consoled by the idea that they died in a noble cause that brought some improvements to people in Afghanistan. There's a terrible moment of disillusion ahead, because the likely outcome in Afghanistan is that after going in, when the country was run by the Taliban in one part and the Northern Alliance in the other half, that when we come out, Karzai and his crooks will decamp to their bolt holes in Dubai that they've tarted up with our money, and the country will be carved up between who? The Northern Alliance and the Taliban. And people will rightly say, what on earth was it all about? We went and joined Bush's war in Iraq. We lost 139 British lives there. We replaced one rotten government and got rid of Saddam Hussein. No one would grieve about that. But it's been replaced by another rotten government. And I'm afraid that people are sent, what has happened in the First World War, where people died in their millions, that nobody can, looking back on it now, can say that anyone died for any purpose. The main result of the First World War was the Second World War. It was a consequence of it. And we should have learned our lessons. And to be involved in a country like Mali, when there are Al-Qaeda groups, not just in Mali, but in Nigeria, in the Yemen, in Somalia, in Pakistan, and a possibility of new wars in Syria and Iran. We've got to come to our senses and say we're not the policemen for the world. We can't send out our young soldiers, brave and professional as they are, to risk their lives into wars that have nothing to do with us and which our interests are not threatened. They're not threatened in Mali, and they weren't threatened in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I'm sure some people will say BP in Mali is quite important to us. But, Paul, I think one of the things that strikes me about what you're saying is how it echoes our conversation we had just last week about the death, I think it was the age of 95, of Charles Chilton, who wrote the original play which the Richard Attenborough film Oh, What a Lovely War was based on. And just how the connections between the First World War and the Second World War, coming right up to today, aren't necessarily made, particularly with this Swiss bank, the Bank for International Settlements, which is where the central bankers all get together, which was set up after World War One to administer reparations against the Germans, and then it ended up actually funding Hitler. After the Second World War, the Bretton Woods Conference ordered this bank closed down, but it's still very, very much alive today in Basel in Switzerland. It's called the Tower of Basel. Anyway, these are big issues, global issues. Let's bring you right down to earth a little bit on the other side of the seven there. I'm a follower of you on Twitter, like many other people are, I'm sure, particularly your local constituents, but you've been tweeting quite a lot about the Brethren, and this is a Christian sect. Some might call it a cult. I will call it a sect. Can you just tell us a bit about that and why it's something that's concerning you?
Well, I've very little knowledge of this and very little contact over the years with the Exclusive Brethren, but they came before the committee that I sit on complaining because they've lost their charitable status. And they've mounted a campaign. It's claimed they've spent £500,000 to win it back. And what I've discovered since, I've found to be so personally upsetting that it's going to be a main interest of mine and lots of peers as well, people in the House of Lords, to correct what we see is the awful situation inside the Exclusive Brethren. I would regard it as a cult. But we had a meeting in the House of Commons this week where former members of the cult and people who were still in it gave heart-rending accounts of how they'd suffered. Some person had bought the wrong computer, would you believe? He bought a computer for £300 instead of buying the Brethren computer, which cost £1,600, in which you can't get onto the internet except for three or four authorized website, and because of that, the person was expelled from the Exclusive Brethren. He's lost his job because he worked for Exclusive Brethren company. He's lost his house and his mortgage. mortgage, because he has this mortgage with an exclusive brethren banking system. He's also in danger of losing his family. And a group of others have pointed out, when there's two stages, they're called being shut up and then being suffering withdrawal. And we heard these heartbreaking stories of people who their mothers or offended the brethren, and they had to move from one family to another. Others, there was a man who gave evidence to us saying that last night in the House of Commons there was a meeting of exclusive brethren where a number came along, and one of the people there, who is a Conservative councillor in Luton, said he saw at this meeting a brother of his that he hasn't seen for 30 years, and that brother can't talk to him. He's forbidden by the church. But this seems to be an extraordinary organization that rule their adherents. Many of them have devoted their cause. There's many good people inside it, genuine, sincere people. But others are kept there by fear of the losses they'd make. This is a sect that needs attention. I believe there was also evidence that the children living within that sect have a level of tension in their family life that's intolerable. And I think there are many people, because this started out as an attempt to get money and to declare that they needed, that they were a charity, whereas the Charity Commission said they weren't, because they practice what they call separation and they're not part of normal society, and they shouldn't get a tax handout from normal society. And they go to the extent of not living in semi-detached houses, and they are not happy if their drains are connected to other people's drains, because they believe that the world outside the exclusive brethren are wicked and they shouldn't be contaminated with them.
Well, Paul, many people have seen the pictures of the Amish in the United States.
Yep.
They also believe, to a certain extent, in actually making a separation between themselves and the rest of society. I mean, surely that's people's right to make that separation if they wish.
There's nothing wrong with doing that. They're welcome to do that if they want to, as long as they're not harming other people. And I think there are examples within various other churches of abuse that have taken place, which in America, where action has been taken against them. This all has arisen because they're claiming they shouldn't pay certain council taxes on their buildings, and that they should have charitable status which gives them large financial advantages. If they're not part of society, they've no right to take those advantages from society. That's how it started. But it's grown from that. We've been stalked by them. I went to a Labour Party conference way back in the autumn, and six times I was approached by members around the House of Commons. You can hardly turn a corner in the House of Commons these days without seeing a couple of them who want to give you a ear bashing on this subject. And I said, I've sat on this committee, and the more I've heard about this group, the more determined I am that they should not have charitable status. The Charity Commission were absolutely right to refuse it to them. But I'm getting greatly disturbed about the accounts we're hearing about the unhappiness in this sect. And there are people there who need our help. There was a speech made by Baroness Berridge, who's a very impressive lady. She's a former, she's got family connections with the Exclusive Brethren. And she called this group together this week to draw attention to the spin that they're putting out there. Now they're claiming, they used to call themselves Exclusive Brethren, they call themselves just Christian Brethren now, but they're not the kind of harmless religious group that one would expect. They do have the characteristics of a cult, and I think many people suffer as a result of it.
Well, thanks very much for that. Fascinating. Now also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, this week we've seen, just within a few days, Jessop's go down, HMV go down, now Blockbuster going down too, on the High Street. They had a big discussion about it on BBC, BBC One Question Time, with the David Dimbleby, the Bullingdon Club member from Oxford. And no discussion last night. I was really frustrated to see that this could have actually being caused, rather than by the internet or by other, actually by government cuts, by the lack of money actually people have got to spend in the High Street.
Well, what happens when you've got a deflationary or depressionary situation, which we're in at the moment, is that the weak links crumble. So Blockbuster Video, which has been overtaken step by step by, you know, internet sales of downloads and so on, they crash at the same time as the whole economy is teetering on the brink, potentially, not just of recession. I mean, I think everybody's pretty much clear that we're possibly going to have a triple dip and it's not going to go anywhere. But what I fear is that we could actually have another crash because, of course, the banks are still insolvent. And if the economy's going nowhere, then there's a potential for a real panic.
I mean, is it really a triple dip? I mean, I don't actually think so. I mean, I see the little bits that the economy seems to be going up as bits of little blips of spin and lots of money spent on public relations to make everyone think, oh, it's picking up again. To me, it looks like it's just a slow slide.
Well, it is a slow slide, and I think what's interesting this week, because what's been confusing most economic commentators is the fact that unemployment has been supposedly falling during this stasis in the economy. But it came out this week that people who are involved in work programme placements and other schemes have been included as employed, when in fact they're basically unemployed. So that statistical anomaly has come to light recently, and that would then fit because the economy is basically flatlining. But a capitalist economy doesn't just flatline. If you get to a situation where nobody can make any profits, then there's a potential for a panic and a crash, especially when you've got all this debt overhang. And I don't think any of the front benches of any of the political parties, including the Labour Party, which I'm a member, are taking on board the real danger of a crash, which could come from any direction. It could come from a Greek exit from the euro, it could come from a failure of nerve about the debt in the US, it could come through, you know, some completely unexpected source. And I think, you know, the debate about all of this has been conducted in a way not to frighten the horses. So you've got the political class do not really want to tell the ordinary folk how bad it is, because they haven't really got any solutions, not that I've got any easy solutions, and therefore everybody talks as if there is a recovery, like everybody talks about as the recovery kicks in what's going to happen. I can't see a recovery, and if there isn't a recovery, there's a potential for a crash.
Actually, Martin, you do have an easy solution, because you came out with it last week under a little bit of squeezing from me, and that was the idea of tax havens, actually reclaiming money from these tax havens, or else saying that it can't be repatriated unless taxes are paid on it. So in other words, people in this country simply won't have access to their money in those tax havens unless they pay tax on it.
Well, I mean, that kind of stern behaviour in relation to tax evasion is only going to take place when people are really, really angry, and I'm afraid they're not angry enough yet. People still hope that somehow we're going to muddle through. I don't think we will, and when we've not muddled through, that's when the serious discussions will begin. But at the moment, the mainstream political discussion is largely, what's the word, it just goes around in circles, and nobody is actually facing the fact, which has been true for 4 years, that the financial system is bust, B-U-S-T, bust. And we're talking as if the private financial markets still existed without government support. They would not exist without government support, it would all have gone down the drain. But of course everybody talks about public deficits, as in, you know, government and local authority deficits, as if they are the problem. The problem is the banking system. It's broken.
Well, sticking with the high street looking at Gloucester Road particularly, a lot of the small to medium-sized businesses running up and down Gloucester Road are really biting their nails after the decision last night to give planning permission to Bristol Rovers to build a stadium just round the existing stadium. Sorry, to build a Sainsbury's on the existing Bristol Rovers stadium build a new out near Lockleys to build a new stadium up there instead. Now, Bristol Rovers is doing really badly in football terms, sort of falling down the leagues every, you know, every once in a while, falling down another league. And yet, so it seems that the only way that they can survive is to get planning gain, to get planning decisions, which will give them lots of money simply through getting planning permission. But the people of Gloucester Road, the people who own businesses in Gloucester Road, are really annoyed about all this. There was a decision last night to grant planning permission for Sainsbury's on the existing site of the Rovers Stadium. The councillors decided by 6-3 in favour. Those in favour were Steve Comer, as Lib Dem for Eastville, Fabian Breckles, Labour for St George East, and Barry Clark, Labour Hengrove. Also Colin Smith, Labour in Bedminster, Leslie Alexander, Conservative from Froome Vale, and Chris Windows, Conservative from Henbury. Those who voted against are Trevor Blythe, Lib Dem for Clifton, Sylvia Doble, Lib Dem for Hengrove, and Tess Green, Green for Southville. Now, a lot of speakers against this were the local Liberal Democrats, and yet the Liberal Democrats who aren't actually don't have their wards in that area voted for it. Martin, what about this? This is a bit, really big decision. Obviously, both the football clubs at the moment are trying to do this kind of swap deal where they buy some cheap land, build a multi-million pound stadium, which will then massively increase the amount of money on their books, that is to say their fixed assets, to then enable the club to have a new financial lease of life, at least on its books.
Well, as you know, this is very divided about this. It's not necessarily on party political grounds. It's to do with whether you're a football fan or not. And I think, you know, these...
What about from the perspective of the traders up and down Gloucester Road? Because that's a unique part of the city, which is like a sort of almost like an old-fashioned high street. Goes for a mile or more, lots of small shops. Now, this Sainsbury's is quite clearly going to force some of those to close, many of those to close indeed.
Well, as you know, I mean...
The entrance is going to be from a mini roundabout in Filton Avenue. Now, if anyone goes up and down Filton Avenue, they'll know that quite often it's chock-a-block, and to have even more traffic around there is going to be cause complete chaos.
Well, let me just make a suggestion. It may be that even though they've voted in favour of this, none of this is going to happen, coming back to what I said earlier about crashes, because suddenly the financial, the chain of credit that's required to make these big investments just isn't there, especially private sector investments like this, unless the government underpins it. So it may be that all this talk of what we would normally do and we would normally argue about whether we should have a supermarket here or not, maybe none of it's going to happen because we're all going to be doing something completely different.
Yeah, Labour MP for Newport West, Paul Flynn. What are your thoughts about the economy generally, and particularly from the eyes of those who have small businesses, shops that can see these big supermarkets kind of moving in and scooping up pretty much all the sales? And even if they aren't scooping up the sales, the internet's taking their business.
I mean, I think these two forces are ones that can't be conquered, and particularly the internet recently, it's growing in strength, and an enormous increase again this year in internet sales, and people are going to find it much easier. And the march of the giant stores, I've got a Sainsbury's opened a year ago, 85,000 feet close to where I am now, and people, there's a shopping population who are car-borne, who will use it, and they won't go back into the town centres. So we've got to realise that the three companies that have collapsed that you've mentioned now, the Blockbusters and Jessup's were a particular form of shop where there was always someone there who was very expert about cameras, and that whole skill is gone because people can take perfectly acceptable pictures using a telephone now. And you know, that trend is unfortunately one that cannot be reversed, and we're going to have to work on planning our town centres to sell particular goods that people want to pick up, want to have a face-to-face encounter with the person in the shop, but most of them are going to into a decline that's inexorable. On the general point, I mean, I agree very much with your other guest, but I make this one point. I believe there are great problems at the bank, and I'm as worried as he is about the possible triple dip, but I'm as consoled listening to the Prime Minister of Iceland, who were in dreadful trouble, and they've got out of it partly by not paying their debts, I may say, in one case, but he emphasized in a meeting in France that they were going to insist on carrying on with their welfare state, and that was he put that as the secret of how they've got their economy back again on an even keel. And the point he made very powerfully is that if we keep up the welfare state, particularly those who are on low income, who are either unemployed or employed on low wages, is the money they get, and people who live on the basic pension, goes into the community and is recycled and is spent again. And he gave us the secret of maintaining the welfare state. Here we're cutting it, and I'm fearful of the future, and I'll be happy when we've got through the next two or three years, and if we can survive without a triple dip, and be very grateful, but the consequences could be very, very serious.
Well, the consequences already are serious for some, and Prime Minister's questions this week, a question was asked on this very point to do with cold weather payments and the 24,000 extra cold weather deaths.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister should know that the ONS have recently released figures which show that there were 24,000 extra cold weather deaths over the winter of 2011 and 2012. The majority of those who perished were over the age of 75. So, Mr. Speaker, can I ask the Prime Minister if he thinks his government should do more to help the elderly and the vulnerable and less to help millionaires with tax cuts?
Well, as I just said, we are doing more to help the elderly and the vulnerable. A record increase in the basic state pension, bigger than what the party opposite would have done with their rules, keeping the cold weather payments at the higher level that the last party only the government only introduced before the election, keeping our promise on winter fuel payments, taking all of those steps and making sure, again, something never done by the party opposite, that energy companies will have to put people on the lowest tariff. That is a record we can be proud of.
If Tony's asking me to comment here, basically, in other parts of Europe, say Iceland or Norway, they have a much better record on cold winter deaths than we do. Why would that be? It's because we manage things incompetently and they manage them correctly. And if you look around Scandinavia in particular, you can see what's wrong with Britain. We ought to be a Scandinavian country, but we're not. And that's why many of our old folk and others are unable to keep themselves warm in the winter when other countries manage it.
Paul Flynn, what's your thoughts on this quite astronomical number of cold weather deaths over the last winter, let alone at the moment?
Yes, I mean, I don't think, I used to, when I was opposition spokesman on this in the 80s, I remember raising this very issue, and it was rather higher than 24,000 at that time. It's a difficult problem. They're not dying of cold. They're dying of other things, but they don't die of hypothermia. Very few. There's a tiny number of such deaths. But there's certainly a great disincentive of people to look after themselves properly by keeping the heat up. And they die of, you know, sadness, depression. They turn their faces to the wall. And that happens in the winter. But I believe that the point that was being made in that question is absolutely right, because we're facing likely increases in domestic fuel on gas and electricity that are unprecedented. And again, it's people blame the extra costs of wind turbines, but the greatest additional cost that we're preparing for now is the new nuclear power stations that are planning to be built. And there isn't a nuclear power station in the world that's ever been built on cost or on time. There are two being built, one in Finland and one in Flamanville in France at the moment. One of them is 3 years late and 4 billion euros over budget, and the other is 3 years late and 3 billion over budget. And we're factoring into the electricity bills the huge future costs. If we didn't do it, nobody would be sufficiently reckless to build them, because they're going to lose money hand over fist. And it was as part of the one side of the Bristol Channel. I still feel desperate that why on earth haven't we harnessed the immense power of the tide that flows up and down between Bristol and Newport every day, a power that's clean, that's eternal, and that's British. And I don't necessarily mean a barrage, because I think there are far better ways of getting the power from that tide than building a brick wall across the Bristol Channel. We should do it with many small turbines that are linked to pump storage schemes in the valleys, so we can use a 24-hour absolutely guaranteed source of power that goes on forever.
There's another point which was brought up at question time this Wednesday, and that was the benefit cap.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is the Prime Minister aware of the trauma facing thousands of families, particularly in London, who live in private rented accommodation, where the housing benefit payments do not meet the rapidly increasing rents, and they're then forced out of their homes, forced out of their boroughs, and the community suffers as a result, and the children's education suffers also? Does he not think it's time to regulate private sector rents and bring in a fair rents policy in this country, so that families are not forced out of the communities where they and their families have lived for a very long time?
Yeah. What I would say to the Honourable Gentleman is that he does have to recognise that we inherit inherited a situation in terms of housing benefit in London that was completely out of control. Some families were getting as much as £104,000 for one family for 1 year. Even today, we are still spending something like £6 billion on housing benefit in London. And I think we have to recognise that higher levels of housing benefit and higher rents were chasing each other up in a spiral. I don't support the idea of mass rent controls because I think what we'd see is a massive decline in the private rented sector, which is what happened last time we had such rent controls. So what we need is proper regulation of housing benefit and making sure we have a competitive system for private sector renting and also making sure we build more flats and houses.
MP for Newport West, Paul Flynn, what are your thoughts about what can be done about this spiralling housing benefit bill? I mean, he pointed out there, David Cameron, £6 billion and going upwards in London, just for London alone. And some individuals, he said, mentioned one individual family that was getting £104,000.
That's been challenged. I think to get that sort of sum, you have to be a family with about four wives or four husbands and something like 26 children. I mean, it really is an extraordinary figure, and, you know, it's questioned whether it actually exists or not. But certainly there's a special situation in London where the rents are crazy, and something that we wouldn't recognise in Bristol or Newport as anything like sensible at all. But there will be problems that will approach with the cap. The cap is pretty arbitrary. It does seem excessive, and I say I'm not in favour of encouraging people or having a system that's going to encourage people not to work, not to stand on their own two feet. And of course there have been cases of abuse, but to put that arbitrary cap in is likely to lead, in certain parts of London where the rents are high, to the problems that Jeremy Corbyn mentioned there. There will be a great deal of turmoil and disruption. But it goes back to the other point, is that money that goes into that, those benefits is spent in the economy, and it goes into the shops and the local leisure facilities. It's not the sort of money that's being cut from millionaires who might well go into somebody's bank account or spent on foreign holidays.
But the trouble is here, I mean, what they're trying to do is they're trying to stop the rents increasing. What's happening is the landlords know that the rent is going to be paid whatever amount they put it at, and so they start upping the rent. I mean, something's got to be done to stop that. That doesn't mean that people have to actually move out of the area in which they were born.
There is a problem there, I think.
Martin Summers, what are your thoughts? I know you're on housing benefit, aren't you?
Well, yes, and I'm also writing a report about housing at the moment for the Human City Institute, so I've been reading quite a lot about this recently. Well, the fact is that we haven't actually produced enough social housing for the people at the bottom third for years and years and years. And housing benefit doesn't, in fact, go to those, the people who are getting £104,000. That doesn't go to the family. That goes to the owner of the property, which won't be the family concerned. And that, in fact, is a massive subsidy to those who have enough money to buy houses to let them to others, which has become a massive industry in this country in the last 10 years. And I think that is, of course, ridiculous. But the way to solve that is to do what the Conservative government did in the 1950s, which is build council houses for ordinary folk so that they've got a real choice about where to live at a reasonable rent.
But I mean, as part of this report, are you factoring in the millions of immigrants, economic migrants that are now putting a demand on our existing housing stock?
Well, are you factoring in the millions and billions of dollars and pounds that comes into a place like London every year from oil sheikhs, from a Russian mafia, from all these people that are forcing everything up? Perhaps we should kick all of those people out. No Saudis, no Russian mafia, get them all out, and then we'll force the rents back down to a reasonable level. Now, it's always the people at the bottom who get the blame for this mess. But as we, as I just pointed out, that £104,000, not a penny of that will go to the family concerned. Even if they, and of course, Paul has just questioned whether that's a real figure anyway. The real problem is we have not really invested in social housing in this country for a generation, and that happened both under this government, under the previous Labour government, and under the Conservative governments that preceded it, and we are now reaping the whirlwind on that.
Okay, Paul, why didn't your previous government, why didn't they build houses?
I think we should have built more, but I think I'd love them.
And that's easy to say afterwards, isn't it?
Yes, but I mean, I've been in housing for a very long time. I was first elected to a housing authority in 1972. I believe we looked at it the wrong way. I think we should look at people's needs for housing, and those that have temporary needs should be given housing that's rented. And we don't do it that way, because I believe that in my time in local authorities, that rent is theft rather than rent is a very poor bargain for most people. And I think that the best thing we can do is get a system where people can get a house they can afford by mortgage or rent, but the mortgage has to be justified so it's affordable. I mean, the tragedy now that's changed within the last 30 years or so, that you're a generation of young people who have given up any hope of owning a house, and see whether we might own a house in our 30s or 40s. And I think it's the impact has been very serious on young people now. And I belong to a generation that's been extraordinarily lucky. It was the first generation who had a health service. We got decent pensions, final salary pensions that no other generation will probably ever see again. And we've made large sums with the capital improvements on our houses. And there's a shift between the generations. People of my generation should see it as their first need to make sure that the chances that we had when we were young to acquire houses at a reasonable price is available to them. But I think the council house argument and the council houses. I mean, we in Newport in the 1960s and again 1970s were selling council houses long before Margaret Thatcher did, and we were doing it in order to get mixed communities, that they weren't communities that were all rental, and other communities where all the houses were owner occupied. In that way, you get one community running down and another community running up. And the idea was that anyone who lived in what was the large council estates at the time, and we should have the chance of buying their house, and the atmosphere changes when you get mixed tenure, and that they were rented houses in the most prosperous part of the town. And I think that's the way to achieve what an Iron Bevan said was that the loveliest feature of British villages is that the doctor, the carpenter, the blacksmith, postman can live together in one street, what he called the rich tapestry of a mixed community. And I think that's what our aim should be.
Well, you had the chance to do that in the last government, Paul, and you did nothing.
I'm not going to be responsible for everything that happened there in the last government, but we did give people housing benefits so they could live. But we end up, and this is disappearing now. So people have the support there, but you get these extreme cases where a house in London, and there are lots of these worth £1 million, ends up being occupied by a family with very little income. And that's when the Daily Mail will go to town on this and say these people are getting huge sums of money. And as your other guest pointed out, it's the landlord that gets the money, and the situation gets distorted. But what we need is to give people decent accommodation that fits their needs through the early years of marriage and up to time when there's only one person left in the family, that can be flexible, that people can move from one to the other without facing serious debt or financial problems. It's not straightforward. There aren't any simplistic answers. But what we should be looking for is the mixed community, affordable houses to suit us all at our various times.
One of the answers that's been put forward by Ron Stone, who was up until recently the acting leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, is using pension fund money to act for councils to dip straight into that to build council houses. Anyway, on to our next story, and this is one of the most shocking I've seen, certainly this year so far, in the Sunday Express. Jimmy Savile was part of a satanic ring. Jimmy Savile beat and raped a 12-year-old girl during a secret satanic ritual in a hospital, according to James James Fielding at the Sunday Express. She recalled being led into a room that was filled with candles on the lowest level of the hospital at Stoke Mandeville in 1975, somewhere that was not regularly used by staff. Several adults were there, including Jimmy Savile, who, like the others, was wearing a robe and a mask. She recognised him because of his distinctive voice and the fact that his blonde hair was protruding from the side of the mask. He was not the leader, but he was seen as an important person because of his fame. She was molested, raped and beaten, and heard the words that sounded like Ave Satanas, a Latinised version of Hail Satan, being chanted. Now, this isn't just one witness. There is another witness as well. Both victims contacted Dr. Sinerson, who's a president of the Institute of Psychotherapy and Disability, while she was involved in the Department of Health-funded study into sexual abuse committed during rituals and religious ceremonies. She said both these witnesses did speak to police at the time, but were vulnerable witnesses, not encountering any surprise or shock, did not dare to give all the details. The police took no action. Martin.
Well, I mean, the more revelations come out about this, the more horrific it all seems. But of course, what's really horrific is the great connections Jimmy Savile had within the police and the establishment,
and
which allowed him to be protected. I think that is what people should be concentrating on, because that, of course, is the nub of the matter.
Paul, what are your thoughts about this latest revelation? It just seems to get worse and worse.
I mean, I'd love to get this out of my head, these pictures we have of Sir James Savile, let's give him his title, and, you know, others who were knighted, honoured by the country, welcome in Downing Street, welcome in Chequers by Mrs. Thatcher, and welcome in Buckingham Palace, that this foul creature who did so much damage to hundreds of people should have been able to get away with it because of his celebrity, because people were frightened to take him on, because he was threatening to sue them if they did, because he had limitless money in which he could buy the silence of his victims. It's an awful scandal. And we've got Sir Cyril Smith again, someone who accusations are being made against him. And why on earth do we get round to honouring these people by elevating them to the knighthood? Who else? We would want a knighthood as the same one that Sir James Savile had and Sir Cyril Smith had. The lesson is one that, you know, we must learn it, children, to give people a voice themselves so they got the confidence to tackle these monsters and report them. There'd been confessions from the prosecution services said that they should have taken up cases. Police have said they were wrong not to follow up the complaints that were made. But there were hundreds and hundreds of innocents and usually children who were abused by this monster. And he's got away with it. I mean, he's managed to die before it all happens. And I think we you know, every one of these stories one occurs plants the picture in our mouths, and it's a foul one and a very disturbing one. I hope that the good might come out of this, is we can give potential victims and victims the confidence to speak out and tell other people, and the police the courage to prosecute, however important and however many rich and powerful friends the perpetrator has.
Well, that's it. At least now the victims are being believed. I mean, that's a big change. For decades they haven't been. Well, another story connected with this in the Mirror last Saturday: cops will fix it. Jimmy Savile boasted that his pals in the police would protect him from child abuse claims. A separate report by Detective Superintendent John Savile looking into how, not the same spelling at all, no, of course, looking into how the force handled three complaints in West Yorkshire said he explained he has contacts within the police, and whenever he receives letters alleging he's done something wrong, he gives them to contacts in the police who simply get rid of them, Paul.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, I've got great respect for the police force, but I know of cases where very bad things have happened. The poor people who suffered in the incident of Liverpool, where the police lied, and for the Hillsborough disaster took place, and we know there was a cover-up there, and those poor loved ones of those who'd fallen had to put up with the lies that were told about them in order to justify the police's behaviour on that day, and they had to wait 22 years for the truth to come out. And of course, we know there are cases that occur. And while we greatly value our police force, certainly one of the best in the world, we must recognise that they are subject to the same kind of temptations that everyone else is, and they sometimes will work to close ranks, to protect themselves and to curry favour with the rich and the powerful. And I think what we have in the case of the News of the World is a very disturbing combination of top politicians, newspaper proprietors and editors, and the police acting as a little cabal together. Working, they share horses, they live close to each other, they share social life, and that's extremely dangerous. And I think we should see, as a result of Leveson, that we break those chains, and there should be divisions between police and the press, and between the press and politicians, and they shouldn't be seen to be a great fraternity working in their own mutual interests.
There's one of the things that's also come out is that the former Justice Secretary, now a man who's sitting around the Cabinet table, Kenneth Clark, was in charge of Jimmy Savile's appointment when he was Health Secretary in, I think, the Major government. I'm not sure if it was the Major or Thatcher government, of Jimmy Savile to Broadmoor. It, obviously, very vulnerable patients there in a psychiatric hospital. So Martin Summers as well, we've heard today in the Mail, Scotland Yard are launching a criminal investigation now into historic claims that a senior aide of a former Prime Minister had links to a paedophile ring. This follows allegations made in October last year by Tom Watson, MP, who claimed a file containing clear intelligence of a sex abuse gang. Allegations that members of an establishment paedophile ring sexually abused boys in council care during the 1980s are now being investigated by police. Former ministers, senior MPs, top police officers and those with links to the royal household are alleged to have indecently assaulted vulnerable underage males in southwest London. A children's home at Grafton Close was linked to a guest house in Barnes called the Elmed Guest House. And allegedly, anyway, boys were taken from that children's home to the guest house for the use of various powerful people.
Yeah, I mean, we've got two possibilities here. You've got paedophiles in high places who are abusing their power to do what they want with young people. There's also another aspect to this, which is the use that intelligence organisations make of paedophilia for blackmail purposes. And so the De True case in Belgium a few years ago, there was clear that he'd been covered up as part of blackmailing politicians, effectively. And there's another case in Northern Ireland, the Kincorra Boys Home scandal, which Ken Livingstone, when he was first elected to Parliament, used his maiden speech to highlight, where it looks as if the British intelligence services have been using the Kingora Boys Home as a way of blackmailing loyalist paramilitaries that they had targeted. Now, I'm not saying I've got any specific things to say about this, because of course this is what police investigations are for, is to try and find out what really went on. But it's not just a question of paedophilia. Paedophilia is linked to blackmail. And why would you want to blackmail establishment figures? Well, there's a million different reasons, isn't there?
Okay. Any thoughts on this? Because he's a Labour MP, isn't he, Tom Watson, that brought this up in the House last year, Paul?
The case I know very well is the North Wales case that occurred some 15 years ago. And a very close friend of mine, who was a journalist at the time, you know, remembers it with and trembles with rage. And I contacted him on this because his contribution to that case in North Wales was very similar in many ways, of young, vulnerable, defenceless people who'd already suffered badly were being abused by a group of very powerful people. And the journalist persuaded one young man who didn't want to go back. He didn't want to churn up the old horrors that he'd been through. And the journalist said, look, for goodness sake, let's do this. We can nail this person who did this. We can make sure he's going to be punished. It's worth doing it. And what happened, the boy did very reluctantly give the evidence. The case was heard, and the man got away with it. He wasn't found guilty, and the boy took his life. And the journalist to this day, you know, is racked with guilt about what happened. And I did raise the case in the House of Commons when this one came up again, because there was a program that the journalist made which was never broadcast. And sadly, it's true that in our society there is a layer of people who are close together by bonds of friendship or fraternity, and they exercise great power. And part of that power is to make sure there's silence on these issues. And the journalist is convinced that there was a link between the defendant in that case and the judge. And if that was true or not, I mean, who knows? But there was an inquiry, and nothing has come out of it. And this is, I'd say, it's war water under the bridge now. Many of the people involved have died. But it is an example that should teach us a lesson that we've got to back those vulnerable victims and give them the strength to, first of all, give evidence, but make sure that the cases are then tried in a way that's fair and reasonable, and to bring some kind of reform to a society so that even those who are in powerful positions and in charge and responsible for vulnerable people could realise that retribution will come their way if they misbehave.
Also, one of the other big issues between us, I mean, since you're on, Paul, as MP for Newport, one of the things that connects us, of course, is the Severn Crossing. Now, let's have a listen now to the MP for Monmouth, David Davis, talking about this very issue, because we've had another hike, haven't we, in actual tolls just after Christmas, and one wonders, if is this ever going to stop? Are these bridges ever going to be paid for?
What our understanding was that when Severn River Crossing agreed to build the second bridge, they took on the debts of the existing old bridge, and that they would have the whole lot paid for, and that at that point it would revert back to public ownership, whereby two things would happen. First of all, once it's back in public ownership, we should see an immediate reduction of 20%, because there'd be no need to pay VAT on for complicated European law regulations, which you probably don't want me to go into now, but there should be an immediate cut. But the second point is that the committee worked out that the cost of maintaining the bridge could be done for about a quarter of the existing price. So theoretically, it ought to be possible to pay a toll of about £1.50 and still maintain the bridge. Okay, the government might want to take a bit extra in order to ensure against the possibility of having to build a third bridge or serious structural damage to one of the existing two. But really, it should be a much, much cheaper toll than it is at the moment.
Paul, what's your thoughts about what's going to happen to this? Because we're being told that, first of all, that we've got a ridiculous anomaly in the amount that's actually paid for. The income is £80 million a year for the bridge, and yet it only costs £15 million to maintain it. And if the Welsh Government were to take it over, Welsh Parliament were to run it, we'd only be paying a pound in a car to go backwards and forwards.
I think that's absolutely right, if you just paid the real cost, and that was the understanding, and David Davis is right there, when those decisions were taken. But I remember when the campaign was running to build the second Severn Crossing, people were willing to commit themselves to pay for it with tolls. But we are badly off compared to other parts of the country now, and there have been decisions taken in order to get rid of tolls. They're a great nuisance to us. I mean, I think there tends to be an exaggeration in the what a burden they are, because all our motorist costs are high. When we work out what we pay in fuel for our cars, for insurance, and so on, I pay, you know, I have to do it twice a week. I do this the crossing, but David Davis is someone who has an embarrassing part in my life, because when I first became an MP in 1988, the first school I went to was Basilic School in Newport, and there was a very stroppy sixth former there who was asking all kinds of difficult questions, and I said to him, the best thing you could do is join a political party, and that person was David Davis. And when I'm asked what the greatest mistake of my political life was advising David Davis to go into politics. But even a stop clock is right sometimes, and he's right on this issue.
Okay, Paul. Martin, what are your thoughts about this? It does seem like a bit of a scam, doesn't it? I mean, there's massive amounts more being paid for the Severn Crossing than it's actually costing still.
Well, I mean, it's the same kind of problem we've had with the PFI contracts and so on for many years. Actually, getting the private sector to do things is often the most expensive way to get it done, and that's just a fact.
OK, well, that's coming up to 6 o'clock now. Thanks very much to this week's guest, the Labour MP for Newport West. That's Paul Flynn. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much, Tony. I enjoyed it very much.
And after the news, Africa in the news this week. Well, actually, we don't have any news at the moment because we've got problems with the satellite, but Africa is in the news this week. A new war in Mali and hundreds taken hostage at a BP Algerian gas plant right on the Libyan border.